It's the BBG, not the BBC. You're listening to the Richie Allen Radio Show, live from Salford in Greater Manchester.
And it's now the 26th of May, Tuesday's programme. What a glorious day in the northwest of the UK. How you doing? Hope you've had a good bank holiday weekend. Welcome to the Richie Allen Radio Show. I've got two terrific guests for you today. Simon Dolan, the successful entrepreneur and race car driver, is taking the UK government to task over the legality of the lockdown. Simon will tell us about that. And former world snooker champion Peter Ebdon will join the programme. I'm really excited about that too. Peter is a healer also. We'll talk about that journey. And he's been on radio here in the UK, national radio, talking about some of the things that we talk about on this programme. And the news media, the print media, lambasted him for that. We'll talk to Peter Ebdon in the second hour about those things. Love being with you. Good to be back. Thanks for your kind messages last week and over the weekend. It is the BBG, not the BBC. I am Richie Allen. Welcome to your Richie Allen Radio Show.
It's the Richie Allen Show. Broadcasting live on richieallen.co.uk and multiple platforms around the world. And now, here's your host, Richie Allen.
And as usual, you join in, join the bleeding well hell in, join in. It's Twitter, it's at Richie Allen Show on Twitter. I'm sure you'll have questions and comments for Simon and for Peter. Do send them to me through the medium of Twitter. Thanks so much for your kind words. Bit of a mini crisis last week with the beloved not being very well. Thanks for allowing me the time off. Not really. I won't take a week off now this spring. I won't get a holiday till probably late August, but that's okay. Thanks, and thanks again to Mark Boyerski, who's a long-time friend of ours. Thanks for your help, Mark. I appreciate that, and I know you're probably listening right now. Indeed. Big shout out to everybody who sent me a nice message, as I said. So Dominic Cummings is everywhere today. Who is he? Well, he's Boris Johnson's closest confidant, allegedly, right? And it was revealed in recent days that when the lockdown began, and we were told you can't go outside and you can't see your grandparents and your factory, your place of work, your business will have to be closed down at great economic expense, at great, well, great disaster to you and to yours. It emerged that Cummings drove around about 420 kilometres to the north, to Durham, after his wife had developed COVID-19 symptoms. So this is a big deal at the moment. I don't think it's anything to be getting our knickers in a twist about. I'll explain why in a minute. It's a distraction. I think it's pure theatre. That's just my opinion. There were some belly laughs, though. I won't subject you to them. I'm sure you've heard the sound bites by now. Some belly laughs. Cummings said he drove from Durham, while he was in Durham, he drove to Barnard Castle before then driving to London. Why? Well, he wanted to see if his eyesight was okay for the long journey to London, as you do. So Dominic felt, I'll take a 30-mile drive just to check the old eyes. And that's his story, and he's sticking to it. They got to the castle, and he was adamant that they didn't meet with anybody, and they sat by the riverbank for 15 minutes. This is world-class lying, of course. We know this because me and thee, well, we're not thick, are we? Right. Now, I know most of you won't get the cricketing analogy, but Michael Gove is a world-class opener, a serious operator. In times of crisis, get Gove out there. Put him out in front of the cameras, because he can take anything, right? He's brilliant. Yes, he's a lot more besides, but he's very good at that. So Gove spoke to everybody, to Sky, to the BBC, and to LBC. LBC, Nick Ferrari. Now, asked about the extraordinary claim that Cummings drove to the castle in order to check his eyesight out to see was it up to the long drive to London, Michael Gove proved what I have suspected for so long. And that is that pathological liars simply cannot help themselves. Feast your ears. It's Penfold. It's the squirrel himself, Michael Goviel. First of all, I think here, Nick Ferrari.
Would you go on a 60-mile round trip to test your eyesight?
I have, on occasions in the past, driven with my wife in order to make sure that... what's the right way of putting it?
I'm staggered. I don't know how you're going to get out of this one, but it's going to be fun.
No. I think people who know me would know that I'm not an authority on driving and that I'm not the best person in the world to ask detailed questions about driving.
No, I merely asked you if you've ever been on a 60-mile round trip to test your eyesight, and you said you had. I mean, why not go to Specsavers?
Well, I've subsequently got in. No, the point that I was seeking to make is that I'm not an authority on driving. As someone who took 7 attempts to pass their driving test, I'm not going to pass judgment on other people's driving.
And Ferrari allows him away with it because Ferrari is in the club. It's pretty poor by Ferrari because Gove clearly, and again it's pathological, he can't help himself. Have you ever driven on a 60-mile round trip to test your eyesight? And Gove says, well, yeah.
Would you go on a 60-mile round trip to test your eyesight?
I have done with my wife.
I have, on occasions in the past, driven with my wife. In
Amy!
What kind of fuckery is this?
Yeah, it's a thing of real beauty. That's what it is. That level of mendacity. Ah, well. Ah, well. So you've had polls today showing the public wants Cummings fired or to resign. It's a distraction, I believe. It could be argued that. I'm trying to teach you all the time. I'm trying to teach you. What do you mean, you big baldy gammon? What could you teach us? Well, I think we can all teach each other things. I'm not any more intelligent than you, but I can teach you things. When you want to persuade somebody of your argument, don't beat them over the head with it. Say it could be argued. I believe it can be argued that it's just a distraction, the Cummings thing. It's scripted theatre. I've written extensively about this on the website. The media is nothing more now in 2020 than the replacement for the old daytime soaps, right? It's a serial drama running 24/7. It's very sophisticated. It's got techniques and production values which create in you and in me sometimes a sense of urgency, a sense of drama, but also a sense of belonging, that we're actually a big part of what's happening. We're no longer an observer, we're a participant, you see. So get onto Twitter and get in on the trends. Do you ever look at Twitter? If you've got a Twitter account, look at it every day. On the right-hand side of the screen, it tells you what's trending. And it's always Piers Morgan, Kay Burley, BBC Breakfast. It's a drama, you see. And it covers up the fact that the news media is doing nothing. Nothing. It's not holding them to account. It's just a propaganda marathon every day. Do you want proof? Here's some proof for you. Sky News will be running live programmes every evening next week called Life After Lockdown, where the channel, which is supposed to be a news channel, will be explaining to people how their lives will change after the so-called pandemic. Every Sky News anchor in the last few days has been promoting the new programme at least twice. Life After Lockdown. How you can expect your life to change. Here's Adam Bolton, Sky News Today.
Now, a programme looking at some of those issues, a series of programmes next week from Monday to Thursday here on Sky News. Dermot Murnaghan's going to host After the Pandemic, Our New World. It's a special series of live programmes about what it's all going to be like once the pandemic is over, what we should be doing. Dermot's going to be joined by some of the biggest names in culture, politics.
You hear that? It's going to be looking at what we should be doing. Rather than Sky News question rigorously and robustly the notion that our lives must change forevermore, rather than hold the bastards' feet to the fire and interrogate them, Sky is actually off its own back, off its own bat, of its own volition, is going to present live programmes telling you and me how we can expect our lives will change. You see what I meant 3-4 years ago when I started talking to you about what the news media is today and why it is on in every bar when they used to be open, every pub, every fitness place, every gym. On in the background, either BBC 24, Sky News or CNN, constantly on in the background. It's not reporting on anything. It's not challenging anything. It is programming you. The Sky is going to run a series of programmes telling you this is how it's going to be.
Politics, economics, science and technology. Now, if you want to take part, you can join our virtual audience.
You can be part of the virtual audience.
From your own home and have the opportunity to put questions to the experts. To sign up, go...
It's shocking stuff. Life after lockdown, Sky News. Today on the Simon McCoy Show, Simon is a BBC News 24 presenter. I'm sure you've seen him. McCoy was doing his programme today and feeding into the programme was a guy called Nick Beak. Nick Beak is a reporter. And Nick Beak was talking about the fact that Boris Johnson has said the shops can reopen on June the 15th, providing that those shops can keep us safe from each other and also the employees safe as well. This is more propaganda. Listen to how Beak, the reporter, lays out what it will be like when you enter a shop after the 15th of June.
We've all got used to food shopping in a very different way during this crisis, and that will continue when other stores reopen. In each place, there's the question, what's changed? Are there now specific entrances and exits? Once inside the store, there may be signs showing a new one-way system. The 2 metre distance rule will still apply. If that's not possible to keep, the advice is to cover your face. We're urged to avoid touching stuff we won't buy. And when it comes to paying, contactless is best.
When it comes to paying, contactless is best, says Nick Beak. You hear that? Again, we're told, we're urged, we will have to, we must. But it's your job, you dozy bastard, to dig down into this and find out, is there any need for it? Are we being lied to, Nick? Dreadful stuff, isn't it? BBC and Sky News today. Programme. It's relentless. Cashless society. This virus, which is harmless to nearly every human being on Earth, is the excuse, I think, it could be argued, to make a huge forward leap in the plans for humanity, right? Right? Okay. A couple of other things of interest for you if you're a Netflix subscriber. They've got a documentary dropping. I've got the lingo. I'm down with the kids. That's what you say now. They're not featuring. Netflix will drop its documentary about Epstein. And there will be a claim in said documentary that Bill Clinton, former US president, was lying when he said he never visited the island. Staff have gone on the record and said that Bill Clinton... I did not have sex with that woman. That Bill was there on the island. Right. And you heard in the news there at the top of the hour, after 2 months, the trading bell rang on the New York Stock Exchange. Andrew Cuomo rang the bell. I had a bit of talk radio on this morning. Julia Hartley Brewer, the thinking man's bit of crumpet. You sexist bastard, Richie. Is it over between you and Kay? Never. So Julia Hartley Brewer interviewed a guy called Professor Carol Sikora, formerly of the World Health Organization. Professor Carol Sikora, right? So Julia Hartley Brewer said to the professor, why are we rushing back? Maybe we should wait a little bit longer. He says, no, we have to live with the risk. Have a listen.
I mean, we're going to have to live with risk. We always have lived with risk. This has focused our minds. We've been petrified by the terrorism of the government. I mean, the message has been so powerful. It's been the most powerful psychological operation that I've known in my whole life, to scare us silly, to make out that you're doing it for someone else. You're saving the NHS. You're saving other people. Great. It is a good message. But that climax is over now.
Amy? What kind of fuckery are you? Did he just say that we were terrorised by the government? fear-mongered into thinking we were doing the sacrifice for someone else. And then did he say that it was good? I think this guy had a change of heart mid-sentence. I think he was telling it as it is, laying it on the line. And then he realised, Jesus, I'm getting a bit too close to the bone here.
We've been petrified by the terrorism of the government.
We've been petrified by the terrorism of the government. Let's hear that again. Come on now.
We've been petrified by the terrorism of the government.
Yes.
I mean, the message has been so powerful. It's been the most powerful psychological operation.
Psychological operation?
That I've known in my whole life.
Well?
To scare us silly.
To scare us silly?
To make out that you're doing it for someone else. You're saving the NHS. You're saving other people.
But?
Great. It is a good message. That climax is over now. We're moving to the next phase. We've got to reduce the fear and get people back to normal.
Great. It was a good message.
We've been petrified by the terrorism of the government.
We've been petrified by the terrorism of the government. Great. It was a good message. My great friend Jean-Anne Crowley is telling me this guy's a famous cancer doctor. I think he was telling the truth there, and then he had a change of heart. Or he heard the of a gun behind him. Somebody was standing behind him with a rifle. It's a good thing, Professor, to scare the bejesus out of people. 19 and a half minutes past the hour. This is the Richie Allen Radio Show, live from Salford in Greater Manchester. Back to Dominic Cummings. A policeman phoned into LBC this morning. Old Bill the copper, whose name is Scott, by the way, is fed up now that when he approaches people who are not obeying the lockdown rules, they'll just cite Dominic Cummings. Interesting exchange this. Scott the policeman on LBC Radio. Scott the policeman.
I've been policing throughout this whole lockdown. I haven't listened to his statement today because I was at work this afternoon, but I've read the bullet points of it. I've given people tickets for sitting in London parks on benches who are refusing to move on, who are breaking lockdown rules, which means they have to pay a fine, etc. I just don't see...
He must be very proud of himself. Is that what he imagined when he came out of the academy? I've been given tickets to people sitting on a bench in a park, minding their own business. And I told him to move on, be Jesus. Get back home because you'll kill us all. And they refused to move and I fined them. Must be proud that, protecting and serving the bejesus out of people in the park, huh?
See, now how I can go to bed tonight knowing that I've made people pay fines for breaching lockdown if it just seems that if you're powerful and wealthy enough that you can do whatever you want.
No, mate. You should be struggling to go to bed and sleep full stop because you're fining people sitting on a bench minding their own business. That's dystopia, pal. That's Orwell and Huxley times 15 to the power of 3. It's mad, right? You should be preventing people from being stabbed maybe someplace or I don't know. Chasing elite paedophile rings, maybe. But going to people on a bench and saying, you know, if you don't get out of here, I'm going to fine you. Yes. What time is it? 22 minutes past the hour. Did he say anything else? Did he?
Yeah, I agree. I think it's it slightly makes a mockery of the whole thing, doesn't it?
Yeah, I agree. In terms of sort of, you ask about what's the lasting effect. So having been out today, spoken to a few people today. It's obviously been a warm day. I've driven around a few parks, spoken to people.
He's driven around a few parks now and spoken to people.
Who are in groups of three or more, and just sort of politely asked them what they're up to and what they're doing.
We're sitting here having a fucking chat, you daft bastard. That's what I would say.
Response I've got from quite a few people is, oh, well, look.
I'm sorry about the language. I try.
Lockdown's over now, isn't it? Why should we bother?
Yeah, they're blaming Cummings. Apparently he was in a park this morning and he said, move on now, you three or four. And they said, what about Cummings? And he's stumped then. Plod is stumped. This is your Richie Allen Radio Show. How are you doing, by the way? How are you doing? Live from Salford, the BBG, not the BBC. We've got a Simon Dolan lined up. Simon, stand by. He'll be with us in a couple of minutes after R.E.M. R.E.M. Losing My Religion. Yeah, the weather is set fair for the week. So if you've got a bit of time off this week, I know far too many people have some time off at the moment. But if you do have a bit of time off, it's set fair in the northwest for at least the next 6 to 7 days. so enjoy. My first guest has mounted a legal challenge against the UK government because he believes the lockdown is unlawful. He's a very successful entrepreneur, and he's even been a race car driver. He is a race car driver too, and he's had some success at that as well. He ran a very successful crowdfunding campaign to cover the cost of the case. Unsurprisingly, a lot of people fed up with the lockdown and wondering about whether it's legal or not and when it's going to end. So let's just welcome him to the programme. You know who he is because the case has been covered in the national media. Delighted that Simon Dolan has given us some of his time this afternoon. Simon, thanks for coming on, and you're very welcome to the programme.
Thank you, Richard. Thanks for having me on.
It's a real pleasure. Simon, tell us at the moment, where is the case then? How is it progressing through the court?
Yeah, these things, for courts anyway, actually moves quite quickly. So we've submitted basically all our evidence now to the other side, which is the government. And they have to respond within the next couple of weeks. And there's a lot of stuff, you know, there's about 1,200 pages of evidence and witness statements and so on and so forth. So these things move pretty quickly. And we would hope the judge will see that on the 12th, I think, somewhere around that date. So we're hoping for the actual hearing to be maybe a couple of weeks after that. So toward the end of June, I guess, the third week toward the end of June.
Wow, so it is moving quickly. I would guess that, I mean, you'll have many contacts in the world of business, I suppose, and finance. I'd imagine you've got a lot of support, I would imagine. I mean, I don't know, but we get probably a couple of dozen emails a week from people with businesses, some small businesses, some medium-sized businesses, and they're terrified as time goes on and they're not trading. They're terrified about what it will mean for them economically. I'm guessing you must have enormous support from the world of business.
Small businesses, yeah. I mean, I've been quite surprised at the level of support on the crowdfund thing. Which was only ever meant to be for a few people to, you know, to help contribute. It was never really meant to go and, you know, go to the extent that it has. The big businesses have been fairly, fairly mute in their response. You know, we were hoping to get Branson on, but of course, most of these guys have got their hand out to the governments, and they have to. You know, it's the sorts of sums of money are just huge. So yeah, there's the small businesses, and they're the ones that are most scared, of course. You know, the bigger businesses can generally survive unless you're aviation.
They can survive, so. The bigger businesses. Now, can you lay out for us in, for me anyway, as straightforward as you possibly can, what's the basis of your case? Do you want to lay it out for us, Simon?
There's 3 points. One is complicated and is a legal thing, so we can probably leave that to one side. The second one is proportionality. You know, in the regulation that they say that they've used, it has to be in proportion to the threat and it has to be in proportion to what's going on at the moment. So we contend that what they have done and what they continue to do, which is probably more important, is way out of proportion to what it's supposed to be protecting. And the third leg to it, if you like, is the basically the breaching of basic human rights, English human rights. There's a number of them, the right to political protest, the right to religion, right to education, and also the main one is the right to enjoy a private property peacefully. So a little bit technical, but you can kind of get the gist of it. And people forget that this is the biggest breach of fundamental rights in English legal history. You know, it's not overstating it at all. Never before has a population been locked up and forcibly, businesses forcibly closed. It's quite extraordinary that there isn't more fuss about it, to be honest.
Yeah, particularly when you saw one or two fairly disturbing scenes. There was one in Liverpool where a man was dragged out of his shop by the police, which went viral, I think, on Twitter. And I suppose a lot of English men, women, Irish men, women, would never have imagined they would ever have seen anything like that. We might come back to the police, Simon, but I'm fascinated by the proportionality aspect of this because I think it's very important. Because I believe that there are men and women in academia very qualified and they're being marginalised or suppressed by the media. They have been saying from day one that the lockdown was a step too far or maybe unnecessary. Now, that's obviously a route that you've gone down. have you got in your arsenal, for want of a better word, have you got experts, you know, people from medicine, from science, who are saying, look, there was no need to lock the country down?
Yeah, there's a whole army, to be honest with you. The problem with scientists, I suppose, is that you'll get some that agree and some that disagree. The government scientists, I think, have been widely discredited. They relied on Ferguson's model, which we all know is completely incorrect. And interestingly, no one's heard anything from Ferguson since. But the government continued to base the lockdown on the numbers that he did, even though they've been entirely discredited. So I think that's interesting in and of itself. But the vast bulk of the science, and I struggle to find any scientist now that would say that there is any reason to have any lockdown whatsoever. And this is where it'd be interesting. You see, the other thing that we're trying to do on the judicial review is to get them to release the minutes of the SAGE meetings.
Right, yeah.
These emergency scientific bodies. And the government have said that they'll be transparent, you know, from the start, and they follow the science. But then they don't release the documents on which they're relying. Well, why? You can only imagine that the reason they haven't released them is they dissent from the government's view. It's another thing that we're going for in the judicial review is to get them to release that. And I think that would be very, very interesting reading and probably quite damning.
It's hugely important, isn't it? For listeners who don't understand SAGE, it's the Scientific Advisory Group for Emergencies. As Simon perfectly explained there, a lot of controversy around, A, the names of the people on this particular committee or group, and second of all, what have they been telling the UK government? Fascinating stuff. Have you been disappointed by the media in terms of how the media has reported on this from the get-go, or were you unsurprised by it, Simon? How have what have your observations been even looking at the media all through this so-called crisis?
It's really fascinating, actually. So I think I've spoken to just about every newspaper, and the journalists on pretty much every newspaper, and every single one of them has agreed with me.
Wow.
Off the record and on the record. You know, there hasn't been one single dissenting voice. And the reason is that they can see that actually it's affecting their jobs, you know, it's affecting the businesses that they work for. So that was really quite fascinating. And then you get, Sky, who were really anti our campaign, you know, pro lockdown, and the BBC quite tellingly haven't picked the story up at all, like literally nothing. And it's not like, you know, it's not being pitched to them and not being advertised, you know, in other places. You contrast it with the Jeannie Miller thing with Brexit. So obviously the BBC quite enjoyed that, because there's 150 plus articles about Jeannie Miller's Brexit case on the BBC, and there is zero about our one. And that's kind of quite telling, because that, you know, in no way is that balanced media.
It's very hard for me to hear that, because as somebody who's produced, you know, commercially and nationally, which I have done, it really is sickening to hear that, because I think you're a bit modest, to be honest. I know some of your critics don't think you are, but I think you're a bit modest. It is a massive case. It's huge, and it's every bit as important as the, you know, the action taken by Gina Miller. And for them not to be in touch with you, especially because you're well known, you're a successful man, you're a colourful character, you're very articulate, how could they not bring you on? It's shocking. I mean, I don't tell people what to do. I never do. I never urge people to do anything that's against the law. I certainly do not. I don't advocate any illegal action whatsoever. But I've never had a television licence. And one of the reasons I've never had a television licence is because what you just told me there. As a citizen, as a taxpayer, I'm entitled to expect the BBC to get you on and to follow the case step by step rigorously. It's disgraceful, Simon.
Yeah, and quite strange. I wasn't really expecting it. Maybe I was. But no, on the whole, in answer to your original question, on the whole, the media have been very much behind it. Interestingly, it's the readers, when they do these readers' polls, especially in the Express and the Mail and the Sun, whenever they run a poll, you know, lo and behold, the poll results come back as being 54% say that you know, the lockdown hasn't been strict enough. And you think, ah, that's ridiculous. How could it have been more strict? You know, how could it have gone on longer? Someone said earlier, we're 63 days into a 15-day lockdown. It's beyond comprehension that people would actually be voting for the, you know, to have a longer lockdown or so on. But then, of course, you know, there's 5 million civil servants that haven't been furloughed and are sat at home, you know, in the sun, it's been nice weather, receiving full pay for doing absolutely nothing. And they're probably the people that might be voting for it. You know, the other people who are sat at home, 80% furloughed wages, probably better off than they were when they were working because they don't have travel costs and they're not spending anything. But man, they're going to have a rude awakening when, you know, when the economy starts opening and people realize that all of those furloughed, I'd guess 80%, and a lot of people I speak to who own businesses reckon somewhere like 80% of people on furlough are going to get made redundant at the end of this.
80%.
And then you see a big shift.
Can I ask you, what are you basing that on, the idea that 80% of furloughed workers will find out that their job is going to disappear? What are you basing that on exactly?
Talking to people I know who own businesses.
Right.
Yeah, big businesses, small businesses. Yeah, you look at McLaren today, I think, have just announced that they've laid off 1,200 people. Which is 25% of that their workforce. It's not their Rolls Royce, 9,000, BA, what, 30,000 or something? You know, it just goes on and on and on and on and on. And these are just the ones that are being made redundant now. You know, when the redundancy payments run out, sorry, the furlough payments run out, then there's going to be a big wave, a huge wave, I think. So I see unemployment in the UK running at maybe 6.5 million when this is over.
And that's 10%. I mean, it's staggering to think that this is a reality, because I tend to think you're right on that. You've been quoted as saying, we are challenging a catastrophic set of decisions which will leave an indelible print from a boot which is stamped on the nation's freedoms and will blight the lives of generation after generation. Because ultimately, what you're saying, I think, and it's something I believe, we've seen it in the past, they're going to come back in the next 12 to 24 months and say that the burden of paying back the loans that they took to mitigate the damage that they caused will have to be paid, and you've warned about income tax rises. It's going to be hellish, right?
Yep, but what they're going to cleverly do, I think, they're not going to call it an income tax rise. They're going to call it something along the lines of an NHS emergency fund or an NHS surcharge or, you know, something to do with the NHS. Yeah, if you've been watching, they cleverly set this up. And I wonder whether the burden will be on individuals or whether it will be on companies. So if you made every company that employs more than, you know, 250 people or something in the UK, if you made all of them pay a 5% NHS surcharge on turnover, not profit, on turnover, that would bring in quite a lot of money. And of course, they know, the government know, that the people or the shops or the big businesses that don't pay this surcharge will be boycotted by the angry masses that say that they don't support the NHS. And, you know, how could you possibly not do that when our hero doctor and nurses have been saving lives and all the rest of this stuff? I think that's where a lot of it will come from. They'll say it's a temporary tax, but of course no tax is ever temporary. And then income tax, like I say, it won't be called it. It will be called an NHS surcharge and probably be a wealth tax, you know, maybe 1% on everybody's wealth. How do they calculate that?
I don't say this to be funny, but I could imagine, I mean, I doubt very much they listen to this particular programme, but if any of them did, they might say, I tell you what, Simon Dolan, that's not a bad idea to introduce, you know, an NHS saving tax. It's the sort of malevolence, I mean, listening to you, it's the sort of thing they would think of, maybe, and would do. The wealth tax I'm hugely interested in. Ever since I read Ed Conway in the Sunday Times a few weeks ago, actually, well, it was a well-written piece by Conway, but ultimately he was in favour of it. And he even went so far as to say that it should be swift and done in a way that would prevent, you know, us getting wind of it and moving our money. A one-off wealth tax on everybody in the country. Basically a bail-in. But that's tyrannical, Simon. I mean, it is, well, isn't it?
I mean, the very fact that they say that they're going to, you know, that they would do it quickly.
Yeah.
They know, therefore, that the effect of it will be to push anybody who's got any money outside of the UK to a country that doesn't have a wealth tax. It's not difficult to move these days, unless, of course, you're in lockdown and aren't allowed to fly anywhere. So, you know, maybe that's part of it. But wealth tax for sure. It would be difficult not. They have to get the money from somewhere. This is the point. So where do they get it from? Well, like all taxes, well, you just tax the rich. You tax the companies. You tax these, you know, these companies that don't pay any tax anywhere. You know, the Amazons and the Microsofts and the Googles, they should pay more. You know, basically anybody who's got any more money than me, whoever that me is,
yeah,
should pay money to bail us out.
I agree with you. None of this should happen, but there is an argument to be made that companies like Google and Amazon and Facebook, they get away with murder, Simon. They get away with murder. And, you know, when you see stories that are verified that Google makes $7 billion in profits in the UK and they, in total 3% of that is taken, that's not proportional or fair. When you look at taxes paid by small businesses, and I know you're in touch, as you mentioned, with small businesses who get screwed left, right and centre. You know, it's just not right that. I mean, I'm not saying I'm in favour of going after companies and imposing wealth taxes on them. You know, I'm not. But at the same time, some of these companies have been getting away with murder forever. And I'm guessing you're not in favour of that. They should pay their way, right?
Yeah, they should pay. They should pay whatever taxes is, you know, is imposed in that country. The problem is they just drive a coach and horses through the tax regulations. And the, you know, the tax attorneys and the people that they employ are way cleverer than the people that are in the HM Custom and Excise or whatever the tax collecting body is in the various countries, because they're paid far more in the private sector than the public sector. So they're kind of always one step ahead. And the very nature of what they do means that they can shift profits here, there and everywhere. It's a big question, you know, because whatever rules, they have to have a rule. You have to have a rule for tax. And whatever rule they put in, they'll probably find a way around it.
Scary thing.
Complicated question.
That's right. And before we come back to the case, which we will, scary thing is the European Union is determined, I think, at some stage in the future to collect taxes from some of the biggest companies in the world itself, isn't it? It's absolutely crazy. I mean, I was in favour of leaving the European Union. I was in favour of Ireland rejecting the Nice and Lisbon treaties. But Ireland did and then was sent back to vote again. But I believe, am I right in saying that? It's one of the stated aims of the European Union to collect taxes on behalf of its member states in the future, which is insane.
Or to force member states that didn't want the tax to receive it. Yeah. Can they do that without Apple?
Yeah, wonderful. Simon Dolan is our guest, by the way. Simon, very well-known, successful entrepreneur, is challenging the legality of the lockdown in the court here in the UK. It's a very important story, this. We've been talking about it with Simon. He's going to stay with us for another 5 to 10 minutes. Thanks again to him for coming on. A lot of questions on Twitter. You can follow Simon on Twitter, by the way. He's on Twitter. If you look for Simon Dolan, you'll get him immediately. He comes up straight away. It's basically at Simon Dolan. You can't go wrong with that. So follow him there and you'll get regular updates on the court case as it progresses in the next few weeks. One or two people very worried about civil liberties, as you are. And some of them are saying to me on Twitter right now, we're very concerned that if the government continues to get away with what it has been doing, that we will see in the very near future people being compelled to vaccinate themselves and things like that. Now look, I know that's a whole other story. I know there are people who listen to this programme who assume or presume that I am anti-vaccine. I'm not. I am pro-safe any medicine. I'm not anti-anything. But a lot of people are very worried, Simon, that this virus, which many of them believe to be a hoax, whether it is or whether it isn't, will be used to justify vaccinations, which at the very least, I suppose, makes an enormous amount of money for some other gigantic companies in the US and elsewhere. What do you think about that in the future? People being compelled to vaccinate lest they be a risk to somebody else. What do you think?
Yeah, like you, I'm pro-choice, okay? So if people don't want to be vaccinated, then I don't think they should be forced to. And if people want to vaccinate, then I think they should be able to do the research themselves and come to the conclusion that it's good for them or it's not good for them, you know? But to have a state mandated injection is pretty scary. It's pretty scary. And of course, it won't be mandated. What they'll do is they'll say, well, in order to travel, you need this passport. In order to have this passport, you need to have this set of vaccinations. And in order to go to school, you need to have these vaccinations. And in order to get a job, you have these vaccinations. And pretty soon you won't be able to live if you don't have these vaccinations. And so I don't think you'll be compelled, you know, by the letter of the law, but you won't be able to live if you don't have one. You know, is that good for the population as a whole? I don't know. You know, it depends whether the vaccines work or not, don't they? It's all about, you know, whether the downside, the people who do get affected by it, are less than the people who are protected by it. And honestly, I don't know the answer to that. You'd assume that vaccines work on the whole. Maybe they downplay the side effects. I don't know. But that's like you say, it's a whole different argument. I'm just against the state forcing you to do something. You know, I think someone said the other day, if someone holds you down and sticks a needle in your arm without your consent, how is that any different to rape? And I thought that's pretty, you know, that's a pretty good point.
Are you horrified to be even talking about this sort of thing, are you? I mean, does it, a man like yourself, you're very well travelled, you're cultured, you know, you've been successful, you are successful, you've met people from, I suppose, all walks of life. Can you believe in May 2020 you're talking about these things? You know, people being arrested for... We had a policeman on LBC Radio this morning talking about the fact that he was basically arresting people because, fining people, getting their details and fining them because they're sitting on a park bench minding their own business and they refuse to move when he asked them to move on. Did you ever think or imagine in your life that you'd be here?
I don't think anybody could. And what's amazing is how quickly people accepted it. That's probably the more scary part, actually, you know, that there was really no, there's been no uprising. There's been no, you know, no particular dissent about it. And that was the thing that got me started on this. You know, I was watching it from afar for however long, you know, 4 weeks or 6 weeks, and looking at the damage it was doing and looking at the numbers and going, gee, somebody's got to do something about this. And then I happened upon an article by a barrister and who said it could be challenged. And so that was where it started. It's scary that they did it, and even scarier that people have accepted it on the back of what? Someone saying that there's a flu bug around? No, okay, it's not the flu bug. It's a cold bug. You know, oh, no, it's not a cold bug. What is it? You know, it's a nasty thing. You know, it's a nasty virus. And it's killed people without any shadow of a doubt. No more dramatically than people were killed in 2014-15 and in 1999-2000. You know, it's not the bubonic plague, it's not Ebola. It's nasty if you're old, basically, you know. And what the government should have done, with hindsight, of course, is just to say, look, wash your hands, be aware that there's something about, which is what they did, and that was what actually gave the biggest reduction in this mythical R number. And if you're old or poorly, don't go outside, because it's a really nasty bug if you get it. That would have been the only advice you would have needed, and you would have seen exactly the same profile, I think, other than the fact there wouldn't have been so many deaths in care homes, you know.
And you have, you've mentioned earlier on, you've got experts whom, I mean, neither you, I mean, I can't speak for you because maybe you have done for all I know, but I certainly don't have any medical training, biology, none of that. But you have people who have the credentials, who are saying that very thing to you, that this was a nasty virus, but there was no need to do this. We should have just been a bit cautious with those who are vulnerable to that and looked after them, but the rest of us should have just gone on and washed our hands and been a bit, you know, a bit clever. You've got those experts saying that.
Yeah. I mean, there's more and more come out every day. Of course, people now start jumping a little bit on the bandwagon, don't they? You know, they can see the tide is turning, and now all of a sudden they're saying, well, yeah, you know, we told you that all along. It's a little bit like, you know, people who sort of support football teams only when they're winning, you know, that kind of thing. There's huge amounts of evidence. Look, everybody knows, and of course it's with the benefit of hindsight, to be fair to the government, they were in a very difficult position. It was an unknown thing. You know, you had all those horrible photos and video coming out of Italy where it seemed to be a disaster. I think they went the right way to start with the herd immunity and, you know, trying to keep things open. And they were pressured, you know, they were pressured by all the media and all the unions and so on and so forth. To lock down, and so they did. And now they've realised that actually lockdown didn't do any good. So why are they still prevaricating about opening up? Well, the reason they're doing that is to cover their asses, to make it look as though there's some sort of science and some sort of plan, and to try and protect their jobs. that's what it's come down to. So it's a combination of incompetence and cowardice, I think, that we're in the position that we are.
Those who believe or who are coming, I mean, I know you've been reading, like a lot of us, you've been reading Peter Hitchens in the Mail on Sunday. And Peter's most recent article this Sunday, I'm sure it was this Sunday just gone, it looks like, if you read between the lines, that Peter is beginning to think the virus is an excuse for the imposition of these draconian regulations. Now, you know, you'll know because you're not stupid that I interview people on this programme from time to time who might be described as conspiracy theorists. Many of them academic men and women, but they've got a different outlook. I believe in my heart of hearts, for what it's worth, and my opinion really doesn't matter here, but I do believe it, that the advice is the excuse, and that these draconian things that we're seeing, that you're taking them to court for, Simon, are things that they desired. I mean, there's an amazing Irish lawyer called Fionnuala Éilean, and she works for the United Nations. She said she's very suspicious at the fact that they've got, you know, hundreds of pages of rules and regulations all ready to go. And she wondered if they were in a drawer waiting for the excuse to use them. Do you wonder about that? Do you wonder that, you know, all of these great writers, men and women of yesteryear, who warned us that we would lose more and more of our freedom as time went on, that maybe we're just seeing that now unfold in front of our eyes? What do you think?
I think it's very easy to get sucked down the whole conspiracy theory route.
Okay.
And you know, I've seen an awful lot. Obviously, people send me stuff in, and some of them are really compelling, really compelling, and others less so. But there's kind of no such thing as a conspiracy theory. There's facts on the one hand, and there's things that aren't right on the other hand. You know, the correct things and there's incorrect things. And there's plenty of conspiracy theories that have turned out to be completely correct. Yeah, and 50 years after the event, or 20 years after the event, or whatever, the government suddenly admit it. And to think that, you know, every government in history has manipulated people in some way, shape, or form, to think that this particular government is the first one never to have done that would beg a belief, wouldn't it?
Yeah,
now, whether it's about this or not is another question. Personally, I just think it's something that came along. I think it's something that they handled badly. But now they're not letting the opportunity go to waste. That's kind of where I'm at. So they're using it for sure. I don't think it was manufactured. I don't think they planned the whole thing, because I don't know about you, I've never met a politician that's been bright enough to pull something like that off. Certainly not a group of them. You know, they're even worse.
It's very plausible.
That's my personal thoughts. But I do love a good conspiracy theory, I must admit. And some of them do make an awful lot of sense. You know, you have to dig pretty deep, I think. And there's a lot of truth there, for sure.
Yeah, it's very plausible what you said there, that it came along and some people decided to jump on it. They saw the opportunity. There's no doubt about that. Simon, just before we let you go, I mean, the very best of luck with the case. I know you're a very serious man and the case is serious. Not to put any dampener now on you being on or the case itself, but I know you'll be aware that the Irish journalists John Waters and Gemma O'Doherty tried to take the Irish government on. Now, that being said, and it pains me to admit this, but the Irish government is as corrupt as any government that I've covered in recent history. In fact, there is something, and you'll be aware of this as a businessman, there is something called the Corruption Perception Index for businesses. And Ireland has always been, well, in the last 20 years anyway, has always had a very low rating. In other words, a bad rating. We're considered to be very corrupt. I didn't expect John and Gemma would do very well, but I wish them all the very best. Did you cover or follow that case, and what did you make of that, and does it mean anything to you here taking on the UK government?
To be honest, I heard about it, but I didn't follow it. I mean, it's interesting you say that. A group of people in France got in touch with me and said, look, we're thinking of doing something similar. Can you share some ideas and stuff? And so I did. And they said it would be impossible to do what we're doing in France because the government and the judiciary are so closely entwined. Yeah. You know, there's no way of doing it. And in the UK, I believe that there is a big divide between government and judiciary. I really do. I think that was proved with Brexit. So I'm actually extremely hopeful. The legal case that we have is really very sound. The kind of only stumbling block for us is the moment, you know, the sort of size of the decision that we would be asking the judges to make, i.e. the most fundamental attack on personal freedoms in the entire legal history, English legal history, was illegal. That's a big thing for them to do. But they will, you know, they will if they believe that the law is right. So now I'm very hopeful on that count.
Where do people follow it online, Simon?
Well, probably the best thing is we put all the updates on the crowdfunding page, and then on my Twitter account, I always, if I'm ever doing an update on the crowdfund, then I always put it on the Twitter account and then reference that site. So that's the best place.
Brilliant. And what is the crowd? Well, I've got it and I can tweet it out again later on, but what is the crowdfunding website again?
Well, it's called Crowd Justice, but if you just, I've no idea what the URL is, but if you just type their name in, or it will come up on under my name, or if on the Twitter account, it's the pinned tweet, you know, those ones that stick on the top. So people could just have a look there. And it's just interesting, you know, you read some of the comments on there. I find them really heartwarming, actually. So if you go on just to have a look at those, it's worth it.
You know what I think, Simon, just as we let you go, and thanks again for coming on, I think it's so huge, this, that if ever a case warranted allowing television cameras in, it's this one. Is that something final? This is the absolute final question. I know you've other things to do. Is that something you've looked into to get cameras in there? Because I think everybody in the country should have the right to watch it.
Yeah, the irony is, of course, it will be done via a video link. Because of the lockdowns, that could mean that we could actually broadcast some of it after the event, I guess. But I don't know that. I've not explored that. But you're right. I do think. But it will be transcribed, and that will be there forever. You know, that will go down in the court cases. So there'll be plenty of time to dissect it.
Thanks so much for your time today. Sticking in that the BBC are ignoring it, I would urge my listeners, and we have a lot of listeners, I'm not bragging, but those in the UK particularly, start tweeting the BBC politely, don't be rude to anybody, and asking them why they're not covering one of the most monumental, one of the most important court cases in our lifetime, and see what sort of response you get from them. Simon, the very best of luck with it. I hope we'll be able to talk again in the near future, and I hope that when we do, we'll be celebrating your success. I really appreciate your time today.
Been lovely. I really enjoyed it. Thanks, Richie. I'd be delighted to come back on.
You're a gentleman, Simon. All the very best. Godspeed to you. Simon Dolan there, successful businessman, entrepreneur. He's challenging the legality of the lockdown through the courts here in the UK, and he's confident that he's got a very, very sound case, as he said to us a few minutes ago. He's got the experts, the men and women of science and academia, who say that the lockdown was entirely unwarranted, that it was disproportional to the actual threat from the virus. And that's what he's doing. And he said that, well, in a couple of weeks' time, it'll begin, didn't he, second, third week of June. We'll follow that every day. We'll report on that on the Richie Allen Radio Show. It is just about a minute to the top of the hour, 6 o'clock, Tuesday, May 26th, 2020, live from Salford. It is the Richie Allen Radio Show. Thanks so much for tuning in today, as always. Got some very good guests lined up this week and next week, and I will be telling you about phone-in programmes as well, because I want to do more phone-in programmes as we go along. Right now, though, I think we'll take a 60-second interlude. When we come back, we'll have headlines and don't forget, former snooker world champion Peter Ebdon. That's a Freudian slip there. Peter beat Stephen Hendry, of course, in the final in 2002, one of the greatest finals of all time. And we'll talk to Peter about appearing on national radio, talking about the lockdown, talking about one or two other things as well, 9/11 and the like, and the negative press he got about that. But we'll have a great chat with him, and we'll also find out about his own journey into healing, because these days Peter is a qualified healer, and I want to talk to him about that as well. I'll be back with you in 60 seconds.
Renowned healer Mark Bajerski travels the world to find the most unique and powerful crystals for self-healing. Since the ancient times, crystals have been used as healing tools. They hold a natural healing vibration and are highly charged in positive energy. Mark teaches how to channel the universal energy and transfer it to the crystal to activate its healing power. Each crystal is used for its unique ability to target a different physical or emotional challenge. Mark Byerski is an author, healer, speaker, and founder of the Pure Energy Healing Academy. He shares powerful messages of inspiration and healing on his daily YouTube videos, reaching millions worldwide. Mark's crystals, healing oils, and incense sticks are most sought after by other healers. His collection is available online at www.markbyerski.com. His work is presented through Lemon House, a company that creates and curates consciously made gifts.
Right, it's a minute and a half past six then. Let's get the headlines from FSN. Don't forget Peter Ebden joining the programme in a second.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Simon Marks. Physical trading is now taking place on the New York Stock Exchange for the first time in 2 months after coronavirus restrictions were eased. Japan's state of emergency has come to an end, and the FBI is to investigate the death of a 40-year-old black man who complained of breathing difficulties as he was arrested by a white police officer in Minneapolis.
Thank you very much, Simon. You are with the Richie Allen Radio Show. It's a glorious evening here in Salford in Greater Manchester. You can tweet the programme. It's at Richie Allen Show on Twitter. And while tweeting it, you can also, of course, engage with other listeners, share your opinions and all of that. I'll mention it again, former world snooker champion Peter Ebden will be on the programme in a couple of minutes' time. Before that, though, we'll take another tune. We'll have a breather, then it's Peter Ebden. Alrighty, I love this. Seven Nation Army, White Stripes, great stuff. Right, it's 5 past the hour then. Music from the White Stripes, Seven Nation Army on the Richie Allen Radio Show. Lots and lots of interest in my next guest, unsurprisingly. I'm delighted to welcome him to the programme. As a massive snooker fan, and I'm not a sycophant, I really am, and anyone who knows me knows that to be true. I know all about him. He won the World Snooker Championship back in 2002 in one of the most epic and amazing finishes that the sport has ever seen, beating Stephen Hendry in Sheffield 18-17. He's been to the final a couple of other times. He won the UK Snooker Championship as well. I think he won 9 or 10 ranking titles. And most recently... sadly, he announced his retirement, but he's kind of moved into the commentary box, and we've heard him quite a bit on the BBC, where he's made a transition to commentary look very smooth indeed. Along the way, in recent years, he's also qualified as a healer, and he's been in the news in the last few days, because when he was on BBC Breakfast Radio a few days ago, talking about his career and snooker, he talked a little bit about why he disagrees with the lockdown, and he talked about one or two other things as well. And of course, unsurprisingly, the print media went in on him. How dare he offer an opinion that differs from the official narrative? But I'm delighted that he did, and I'm delighted to welcome to the programme, as I said, former world champion Peter Ebden. Peter, thanks so much for coming on the show today. How are you?
You're very well. You're very welcome, Richie.
I'm
very
thrilled.
Well, thank you.
I'm thrilled to bits. I mean when I say I'm not a sycophant. I've never missed a major snooker tournament since I've been about 10 years of age. And your final in 2002, I mean, millions and millions of people watching it. It was, I've never witnessed anything like it in my life. I'm a bit too young for the 85 final and all the drama there. But no, it's a genuine pleasure to have you on. What have you made of, before we talk about, you know, the healing journey and all of that, what have you made of the kind of furore over your comments, which I felt were fairly benign? You know, you're a man who takes an interest in independent media and in, you know, in alternative explanations. What did you make of the reaction to your fairly innocent comments on BBC Radio? What did you think?
Well, sadly, it wasn't very surprising, Richie, and I'm sure that you're not too surprised about that either, but it seems that whenever anybody sticks their head above the parapet, if it goes against the norm at the time, you know, people tend to get shot down. And but, you know, I understand what newspapers are like. I remember the first year when I turned professional, I was the leading rookie at the end of the season, but I'd won 8 or 10 matches to qualify for the Crucible. And I ended up getting drawn against Steve Davis. And I remember the press coming round to my house and doing a few interviews. And they asked me how I thought I would do against the snooker legend, Steve Davis, six times world champion. And I said that my preparation had gone really well. I was practicing 8 or 10 hours a day. I felt that I would take my chances if I was given them. And that transpired, back page of one of the daily newspapers the next day, I will definitely beat Steve Davis. I never said that at all.
You never said it at all. I remember it well, that a beating of Davis in the first round. You went on to win that game, of course.
Yes, I did. And I got to the quarterfinals that year. I played even better against Martin Clark, who was a top 16 player at the time. And then I lost, I think it was 13-7 to Terry Griffiths, who just played absolutely brilliant snooker against me. But, you know, to end up the leading rookie at the end of my first season, number 47 in the world, I turned pro the same time as 500 other players. And to win all of those matches, the qualifying matches, and get to the quarterfinals of the World Championship in my first year, I was absolutely delighted.
I've met over the years, in commercial radio, I would have met professional players, various players over the years. I got to know Ken, interviewing him from WLR in Ireland, and one or two others I could mention but I won't. They always said two things about you. One, you're the hardest guy they ever faced on the table, and two, that you're a hell of a nice guy. And the thing about that story you told us there, what a wake-up call that is. You give an innocuous comment to a journalist saying, I'm going to prepare, or I have prepared as well as I can. If Steve gives me chances, I'm confident I'll take them. And they stitch you up and say that, you know, you claimed that that you'd beat him, putting you in a terrible position, of course, as well, going into the Crucible. Your interview with Mark Chapman was a lovely interview to listen to. And Mark Chapman, the presenter, obviously enjoyed it. And he was intrigued by the things you were saying, as anybody would be. But for the press then to go in on you. But look, we'll come back to that as we go along. What have you made then? For our listeners who haven't read the stories and who didn't hear your interview on Radio 5 Live, for them, what are your impressions of what's been happening in the last two and a half months? The lockdown, the effects that is having on people, what it means for all of us. What do you think, Peter?
Well, in all honesty, Richie, I've been paying very close attention to alternative experts, because I don't particularly trust, to be perfectly honest, what comes across in the mainstream media. I don't watch TV at all. I'm very happy doing bits and pieces on social media, but there are plenty of fantastic experts out there. One of the guys I've been paying attention to is a guy called Dr. Vernon Coleman, and he brought a video out on YouTube. It's one of the videos that hasn't been taken down by YouTube. And isn't it strange that all of the videos that seem to be going against the official narrative seem to be taken down at the moment, which is very telling in and of itself. But he made a video yesterday, I believe it was, called Coronavirus, Mental Health Problems Will Now Soar. And he makes the point that regarding mental health issues arising from the unnecessary lockdown and social distancing measures, he mentions the book that he published in 1978, when he was one of the first doctors to start talking about the importance of stress, and he was absolutely ridiculed. He's got 50 years experience of studying viruses. He commented on, with regard to the current virus, the UK government public health policy, which downgraded the virus, I believe it was the 17th of March, from a high consequence infectious disease. That was 6 days before lockdown. So it was actually downgraded by the government. He talks about civil rights disappearing, many people around the world living in a police state. He then, in the video, he said he comes to a conclusion that it can really only be one of two things. He talks about the level of censorship, and then he talks about the government and their advisors are either very stupid or, far more likely, there has been a conspiracy, in his words, to quote, there has been a conspiracy to exaggerate the danger of the coronavirus in order to grab power and damage our rights and freedoms. Governments have done everything possible to create more anxiety and to exacerbate the incidence of depression. Everything that the government has done in the UK, for example, has been designed to create loneliness and a sense of fear. The lockdowns and absurd social distancing policies were never necessary, but they are now destined to be part of our lives indefinitely. The threat that lockdowns will be introduced will be kept hovering over our heads, and we are told that social distancing policies must be maintained indefinitely in case this well-marketed brand of flu reappears. He then goes on to say that 28 million surgical operations have already been cancelled or postponed because of the virus, and every week the lockdown lasts results in another 2.4 million cancellations. I mean, it's just, it's absolutely ridiculous. So this is a very, very well respected doctor, and for me, he's on the money.
And it's a source of great frustration to me, Peter, that first of all, that we don't get to hear men and women like him. And, you know, I've made this point on programmes in the past, and one or two people who do listen, but they don't agree necessarily with what they hear on this programme, they say, Richie, he's talking nonsense. And I always say, well, he's earned the right to his opinion because of his credentials. And it's not for me or for you to say that he's talking nonsense. Why wouldn't the national broadcaster invite him on and put him up against one of these guys, you know, like Chris Whitty or somebody like that? That's the crux of it here. They're burying these guys who have the credentials, who have the academic qualifications, and who are saying something a bit different. I'm going to do something I wasn't planning on doing, Peter. I'm going to play a 16-second audio clip that I used in today's news roundup. It's from Professor Carol Sikora, because I know that there are more people listening to this programme today than normal, because former world snooker champion Peter Ebdon is on the show. And you've heard Peter there talk about what Coleman said about the fear-mongering by the government. And you might just think, Peter Ebdon is exaggerating. He isn't. Listen to what Professor Carol Sikora told Julia Hartley Brewer on talk radio this morning. It's very important, this.
We've been petrified by the terrorism of the government. I mean, the message has been so powerful. It's been the most powerful psychological operation that I've known in my whole life, to scare us silly, to make out that you're doing it for someone else. You're saving the NHS. You're saving other people.
What do you reckon, Peter? He said, we've been petrified by the terrorism of the government. This is a guy who is a cancer specialist who used to work for the World Health Organization.
I think that's absolutely true, and I think that the World Health Organization, to be perfectly honest, have got a lot to answer for, because they were the people that called this a pandemic, a so-called pandemic, in the first place, and there are very few deaths. I don't know, Richie, I mean, you probably know a lot more about this than me, but wasn't it 4 or 5 years ago there were very high-level bonds or something that were taken out, and for the bonds to be able to be matured, a virus, a pandemic, had to occur by the end of 2020 or something like that?
I've seen that as well, Peter. And again, there's a lot of truth in that. I mean, you mentioned 4 or 5 years ago, also at that particular time, we had a pretty nasty flu season, which I believe, because I've looked at quite a bit of evidence, I believe the death rate then is far greater than that which we've seen now for this so-called pandemic as well. Peter Ebdon is our guest, former world snooker champion. Peter is also a qualified healer. We're definitely going to talk about that. Loads of comments on Twitter here. Base Ninja says, nice to hear a pro sportsman pretty much nail it and passing the info on when he can. It begs my noodle why people don't see that the mainstream media avoids other experts like the plague. That's the crux of it. They're out there. But I mean, even Oxford University, which is kind of full scale behind the attempts to get a vaccine out there, they've one of their own epidemiological experts, easy for me to say, a guy called Carl Hennigan. Hennigan has been saying to anybody who listen in recent weeks that the lockdown is entirely unnecessary. It was unnecessary to begin with, and we should end it now. But I think he was given one interview on Newsnight, and that was weeks ago, and we've not heard from him since. Hugely frustrating, Peter, is that. What, I mean, you mentioned there about I might know more about than you. I certainly do not, or anything like it. But what I'm fascinated, every time I talk to somebody, I'm fascinated to ask, like, their own personal experience, you know? Because my experience is, in my kind of wide circle of contacts and friends and neighbours, I don't know anybody who's been seriously unwell. And I live pretty much 300 metres away from one of the biggest hospitals in the Northwest. And I know two people working there, one of them was a nurse, and they reliably inform me that the hospital hasn't been under any pressure whatsoever. None. And they've not been inundated with cases, even with senior citizens or people with underlying conditions. And they're a bit baffled by that, Peter, would you believe?
I think we've seen videos that have been shared all across the internet from people that have been disobeying the lockdown order and going to the local hospitals. And this has happened all over the world, and they've just walked in, there's nobody there, and they're taking videos. So it's quite obvious that this so-called pandemic is really nothing of the kind. And if you look at the latest statistical information from around the world, I believe that the worldwide death rate now is something like 0.004 of the population.
Again, you know, throwing, you know, exposing massive holes in the official narrative that this is a deadly virus. We heard from Simon Dolan in the first hour, he's taken the government to court, and one of the things that they're talking about, Peter, is proportionality. And his experts are telling them there's absolutely no need to lock the country down, and that the claims early on that this is going to kill a lot of people. I mean, Ferguson was saying maybe 250,000 people in this country, wasn't he? And that's not borne out. I suppose they'll say the lockdown has probably prevented that, but that's nonsense. I want to get into with you, if it's okay, because I'm fascinated. I don't believe that well-known men and women, celebrities, sportsmen and women, you know, are different to the rest of us. I mean, you're obviously different in terms of you have a great skill, a great talent that you got the most out of, hugely successful. But I'm always fascinated when well-known people say to me, Richie, I got to the stage where I just couldn't take anything from the mainstream media other than with a pinch of salt. I couldn't believe it anymore. And I'm fascinated with you, Peter. Was there a point, was it a gradual thing with you over the years, or did something happen that made you think, wow, there's something going on here that I'm not comfortable with? Was there one event, or was it an accumulation of things for you?
Well, if I think back, being totally honest with you, I remember the year that I beat Ronnie O'Sullivan in the World Championship, 13-11. And it was in the back page of one of the newspapers the following day that a journalist and former professional sportsman, for me, he really crossed the line. He actually accused me of cheating in that match through slow play, and yeah, I thought that was absolutely disgraceful. My wife, Deborah, at the time, pleaded with me not to sue the newspaper, but I decided to sue the newspaper out of principle. But the journalist was very clever the way he brought the story forward, because he said in a comment piece, and this was the whole thing, it really came down to a technical point of law, unfortunately. He said the one word that crossed my mind when watching the Ebden O'Sullivan match was ... cheating. So I sued the newspaper in question, and I was advised to go down the arbitration route eventually, having secured a no-win, no-fee deal with my solicitor. And the presiding judge in the arbitration actually decided that it was a comment piece and not a factual piece. So it was purely on a technicality. And I ended up losing that case. And because I had no win, no fee, I just had to pay the disbursements. But that really did leave a very bitter taste in the mouth, so to speak, especially when it was only 2 or 3 months prior to that, when a football manager who was accused of running his club shabbily by the same newspaper won a court case against the same newspaper and won £250,000 worth of damages.
I could never understand that case. I'm a qualified journalist, and I used to teach journalism. I used to teach broadcasting. And libel law is something that I've had to be an expert on, Peter, for obvious reasons. This particular programme could be brought to its knees through my stupidity if somebody was to be libeled on it. So I know it inside out. Your case was a stone-cold case of libel. You were libeled. I remember the incident. I remember the match. I remember the nonsense that went on around it. Obviously, being a huge snooker fan, I am. I've been to the Crucible. I've been to many of the venues in the UK watching it over the years. I've seen you play. I'll talk to you about that another time. I remember that as an open and shut case of libel. Guy said you cheated. You obviously didn't. It's a no-brainer, and I couldn't understand it. And it left a bad taste in your mouth then, that. And
yeah, absolutely. And I think a lot of people forget that in that match, I believe I'm right in saying that Ronnie was world number one and world champion at the time, and he played phenomenal snooker to go 8-2 up.
Yeah.
And I didn't play fantastic, but I did what I ended up doing pretty much throughout my entire career. I just kept trying. I kept trying, and I didn't give up, and I kept persisting and persevering, and I gradually fought my way all the way back into that match. And from 8-2 down against the best player in the world, who was playing at near genius levels early on in the match, I ended up winning 13-11. And even though I didn't play great, it was one of the proudest moments of my career, the fact that I fought so hard.
Yeah, you dug in, yeah. You could ask me, if you wanted to be cheeky, you could say, who would I have been shouting for? I was always a fan of the Irish guys, obviously, so I'd have been a big fan of Ken and the other Irish players, Farragul, of course, and these guys. But I remember that incident really well. And that sets off something in your mind then that, well, something's not right here, you know? I mean, obviously, the law should have protected you. Of course it should. It should have found in your favour, like it was an open and shut case. You know, I would expect, if I'd have been writing about that match, if I'd have said Peter Ebdon is a cheat, I'd have expected to lose my job and for the paper to end up paying damages. But they didn't. And you began, was it after that then, Peter, that you began to look at, say, other sources for information? So you don't just get your info from the broadsheets and the tabloids anymore. You start looking around, presumably online, I suppose.
Yes, absolutely. But I've always been, you know, very open-minded. And that's one of the reasons why I ended up becoming a professional healer. I probably have very few interests. So outside professional snooker over the last 30 years, my main interests have been pedigree research with thoroughbreds. I've been very interested in genetics, you know, bloodlines, line breeding, which is the reinforcement of superior ancestors, and also healing as well, which has really sort of come to the fore in the last 7 or 8 years. I think, to be perfectly honest, the big point in my life was losing my dad to cancer in 2011.
Yeah, I remember that. And what was it about your dad dying, Peter? Was it about how he passed away? Was it about the treatment that he had? Was it about things that you discovered after he passed away, God rest him, that made you think, wow, maybe there's maybe another way, maybe, when dealing with that? Was that it?
I think it made me, you know, take a really close look at my own life. And it was later that year. My dad passed away at the end of May in 2011. And it was in the November of that year when I became vegan. I'd done a lot of research on diet, nutrition and cancer. And, you know, I'm very pleased to say, through what I've learned from that, I've been able to help people. And that also has actually been a huge point of contention for me, because, as you probably know, there is an act called the 1939 Cancer Act.
Yeah.
And really, in law, you're not allowed to even speak about cancer to people, because it's only the you know, radiation therapy, you know, the surgery, drugs, you know, that sort of thing that you're only allowed to, you know, speak about. And I actually remember wearing a Gerson therapy logo, and this was the year after I lost my dad. And I'd researched Dr. Max Gerson, who was curing stage 4 terminal cancer patients in the late 30s, early 40s, with organic fruits and vegetables and juices. And it was just unbelievable because he was actually terribly vilified in America because of the big business that cancer is, unfortunately. And I remember wearing a Gerson Therapy logo the year after my dad died in the World Championship. And I was called into the offices of World Snooker halfway through the match. And I spoke to Miles Pearce from World Snooker, a lovely guy. And he said, Peter, we've had complaints from all around the world. You have to take that logo off.
No way, Peter.
We can't allow you to continue to play with that logo on. And the words that he actually used were, for your own safety.
How did I miss that? Did that make the news, Peter, that them telling you to take off the logo? Because I don't remember
it
did it?
Yeah, it did. It was in all the newspapers. So, you know, it got tremendous publicity for Gerson Therapy. You know, they still can't practice Gerson Therapy in America. So a lot of the clinics are in Tijuana, across the border in Mexico. And I mean, Gerson, it's such a sad story because that man was an absolute genius. And 80 years later, whereas he was curing stage four cancer patients at 50% with organic fruits and organic vegetables and their juices, 80 years later, we're in a situation whereby the five-year survival rate for somebody that has had radiation or chemotherapy is something like 2.5%.
It's very low. Yeah, it is very
incredible.
Low.
Incredible. Yeah, it's very, very low. So
Max Gerson's
name. Gerson, unfortunately, he was murdered. He died of arsenic poisoning. And that was not the first time that he was poisoned. When he was writing his manuscript, cancer, a result of 50 patients, he was actually poisoned. And it took him about 18 months to get himself better again. He wrote the manuscript. The first 50 survivors went to the US Senate, if I remember correctly from the book, to testify that his treatments had helped them to recover from cancer. And all of those records were struck from the records in America. It was disgraceful. And they ended up murdering him in the end. He died of arsenic poisoning. I think it's so sad.
His name has come up a few times over the years here. Max Gerson, Peter is talking about, if you're new to it. And I don't know if there are any copies of the book in existence or for sale. There might be, but the book came out in the very late 50s or early 60s, didn't it? A Cancer Therapy, it was called.
That's it, yeah.
What Peter has said there is right. This guy was, as far as I remember, he was a Jewish physician. And he was having success. He claimed he was having great success at treating cancer in the way Peter described there. What Peter said there about the Senate testimony, that's all true. That was all struck. I didn't know, Peter, that he ultimately he was murdered. But I know that the National Cancer Institute, and I know a lot of our listeners will say, yes, Richie, but we know there's a revolving door system there, like there is with Big Pharma and the World Health Organization. But they did everything they could to discredit him, didn't they? To say
that
he was wrong. And they even said he was dangerous. But of course, taking juices and eating fruits and vegetables, how could it be dangerous in any sense of the word? But you're right, the Cancer Act of the 1930s prohibits people in this country under serious penalty of, of court and serious fines, prohibits anybody from claiming, even if they have managed it. I've got to be careful what I say here, but I have had people on this programme in the past who've talked about natural remedies and natural treatments, but they are precluded from making a claim that they've had any success under penalty of litigation. It's absolutely crazy. We continue to tell people that the only way to treat cancer is to pump yourself full of radiation, effectively, that will kill pretty much every good living cell in your body. It staggers me, but yeah, and that's about as much as I can say, Peter.
Well, that's one of the reasons why you can incredibly boost your natural immunity through a vegan diet. You know, organic fruits and vegetables, you're going to boost your immune system, and that's what people could really do with now. And some of the people that I've been, researching recently, like the incredible woman from Ireland, Professor Dolores Cahill, she's really, you know, taking on the Irish government.
She's saying that
all of the advice that we've been given is terrible. She's saying that, you know, we can really, you know, build our immune system, and people should be going out in the sun and not doing the social distancing. They should be taking vitamin D and vitamin C to boost their immune system. And she is one brave lady. I've shared her videos on YouTube and they've been taken down, and you know, she's somebody that I've got tremendous respect for. And you know, her qualifications, you'd be reading her qualifications for the next half an hour.
It's rotten, isn't it? Because here's a UCD professor whom is renowned in her field, has spoken around the world in years gone by, is very highly regarded, just as Peter said. And in Ireland, she's gone on the record as saying, exactly as Peter just said there, that it's a nonsense, the lockdown. There's no need for it. And she's outlined, I think, in great detail in the video you mentioned, using slides to explain why she has concluded what she has concluded. And she's the Irish media has again gone in very heavily against her, and YouTube has taken her videos away. And I just wish more... Are you... Peter, you're... Again, you're like Simon before you on the programme today. You've travelled around the world. You're a cultured man. You've been around the world. You've met people. How frustrating is it for you that, you know, regular folks, like, you know, our neighbours and our friends, that rather than be really curious as to why academic men and women are being silenced and being deleted, that they're more inclined to go along with the lockdown and even demand more lockdown? Is that driving you mad? Because it's driving me mad, Peter.
It is driving me mad, to be perfectly honest, you know, and I try to remain grounded and centred and balanced, as I should do as a healer. But, I mean, for example, I know I've already told you this story in an email that I sent you, but the interview that I did with Radio 5 Live, there was a guy in his early 80s who is absolutely petrified and has been since the coronavirus came about. I spoke to him. He got in touch with the College of Healing in Malvern, and Jess from the College of Healing got in touch with me and said, you know, this guy's been on, would you possibly call him? So I called him and spoke to him for about 40 minutes, and he was absolutely petrified, and he had a mental breakdown about 5 weeks ago. This is a man who's in his early 80s. He's got two granddaughters who are on the front line in the NHS. And he was so fearful. It was so sad to see. I put him in touch with one of the more experienced healers at the College of Healing, who sent him distant healing, which is absolutely amazing. And he immediately felt better. I really think that he's going to be struggling, though, to be perfectly honest, because the information that I passed on when I spoke to him, you know, his self-talk was very, very negative, you know, and he was coming from a place that he couldn't cope. He couldn't see a way through. He couldn't see a way out. And I'm very worried about him.
Ah, Peter. Yeah. And like yourself, the show gets a lot of emails from people who are in the same situation. It's killing people. You know, I've seen it in my own family, what it's doing to people, this lockdown. I don't think anybody...
It's the fear.
It's evil, isn't it?
It's the fear. The fear is terrible.
Even today, Peter, they're saying that if the shops open up in this ridiculous way, they plan to open them up on the 15th of June with, you know, social distancing and, you know, one entrance and one exit, and you can't enter this way and that way and all this nonsense. They reckon that people have been so... terrorised, as we heard from the former WHO professor earlier on, they might even be reluctant to come out. Do you think that is a possibility, that, you know, large numbers of people might not actually decide to return to their jobs even, or start going back out on a Saturday afternoon to their local towns? Do you think that's a realistic possibility?
I think it is a real possibility. And it's just such a sad situation. I think it's just been so unnecessary. And, you know, if this has been orchestrated and if it has been planned, as far as I'm concerned, that is really evil, because people are being kept away from their loved ones. You know, we're human beings, touch and love, and people need to be hugged. You know, all of these things is so important, and social distancing is just absolutely destroying that. And, you know, when you look at the somebody as renowned as the scientist, you know, Professor Dolores Cahill, who we've already mentioned, you know, when she says that these things are absolutely unnecessary and she's prepared to put her whole reputation on the line to go against what the government are telling everybody, you know, people really need to sit up and take notice.
Yeah,
but can she get a slot on mainstream media? No, she can't. I think it's terrible. You know, people are just getting one-way traffic, you know, and the fear that is being broadcast through mainstream media is absolutely terrible. I mean, it's okay for somebody like myself, you know, I've researched psychology, personal psychology for the last 25, 30 years because it's been really important to me in my profession. And I remember when I was listening to people like the late and great Zig Ziglar, when people would talk to him about fear, he said, oh yeah, fear, it's just the acrostic for false evidence appearing real. And that is truer now today in this current crisis, this made up crisis, than it ever has been. But for the older people, the elderly people, they just can't see a way out. They can't see any hope. And, you know, I think it's so sad. I think that there is so much positivity that can come from this situation. And but people need to understand that they need to be strong in their mind and see this for what it really is. And as Dr. Vernon Coleman said there, it's a power grab. And people really need to, you know, stand up, you know, for their rights.
Peter Ebdon is our guest. It's 20 minutes to the top of the hour. Peter is very, very talented and very successful snooker player for many, many years, winning pretty much everything in the game. Multiple world championship finals, won it in 2002 in one of the greatest games ever seen, one of the most thrilling climaxes you'll ever see to any sporting contest. Great guy. In recent years, Peter has qualified as a healer. We've been talking about that, and he's been chatting to us about his thoughts on the lockdown. And I do not want to make you upset, but I just want to draw, I want to go back to what you said a moment ago about your dad, because John Waters, the Irish writer, was on this programme a few weeks back, and John very, I think, succinctly described the horrors of keeping people in care homes or people in hospices who are coming to the end, you know, to the end of their lives, keeping them from the touch of a loved one. And it's obvious you became a little bit emotional there, because your dad passed away in 2011, I think you said, Peter, I think it was. You weren't denied that opportunity to be with him. So it obviously means something to you, knowing that there were people being denied, you know, that love, that companionship, that kind of necessary kind of goodbye, because that's a part of the grieving. Grieving begins before somebody who's very ill dies, of course. I think it's fair to say that. And you're looking at that now with that experience of seeing your dad pass away. It is evil. It's absolutely evil. And to see the BBC running stories yesterday suggesting that some care homes are now going to have drive-by visits. Did you see that?
I did see that, and I think that's absolutely disgraceful. You know, Richie, in all honesty, I think that the whole world has gone completely mad.
Yeah.
And the fact that more people are not up in arms about this, you know, the fact that they're having their liberties, their freedoms taken away, I find it literally incredible. It's almost like we're living in some sort of twilight zone. 6 months ago, nobody could possibly have imagined the situation that we were in now, other than the people perhaps that had planned this all along.
Yeah, I'd be the first to agree with that. I mean, I over the years, I thought that, you know, down the line, this is where certain people kind of want us to be, you know, kind of kettled or corralled, and the sort of power grab, I could see that's where they wanted us to be, but I never saw this happening. And like you expressed a bit earlier on, the thing that's really upset me about it is obviously what's happening to people in care homes, older people. Like yourself, I have empathy, but I'm just horrified by the acquiescence, by people just going along with it. And it's taken me quite a time to come to terms with that, because I did have a little bit more faith in people. Can I ask you, I'm certainly not asking for any names, but you know a lot of people, Peter. Are you hearing that amongst your peers, your former fellow professionals? Amongst them, are some of them getting a bit antsy? Are they having these discussions about this lockdown? Are they starting to see through the charade, again, without asking for any names, because that's none of my business, are people starting to see through it, do you think?
To be honest, Richie, I think that they're like most people, and they're very, very compliant. You know, the only way that I can logically explain that is that people are becoming so brainwashed by watching mainstream media because they're not being given the alternative. You know, there are plenty of alternative outlets out there. One of the programs that I like to watch on a Monday, Wednesday and Friday on YouTube is the UK Column program. And those guys are doing a fantastic job. And it's just so different from mainstream media. I just wish people would wake up, but they can't wake up because they're being brainwashed 24/7.
Yeah.
Every single channel on mainstream media, every single newspaper.
And it's left to us then to interview people like, I've not interviewed Dolores Cahill now, but I've had other qualified men and women on whose qualifications are the equal of the government mouthpieces. And we're left then to try and give them a bit of a platform. And however successful we are, we're still a drop in the ocean compared to the BBC or Sky News. So it's a constant battle. And it's a terribly frustrating thing. You know, I've said it to some guests in the past. I've said, Jesus, you know, it's been great having you on, but really you should be saying this on Newsnight, or you should be saying it to Jon Snow on Channel 4, but that's not the way it is. And I worry that as, I mean, the hegemony enjoyed by Google, YouTube, I think in the very, very, very near future, they're going to start coming after, not me particularly, I mean, I don't have any ideas about myself or this programme, but I think in general, they're going to start looking to make it more and more difficult for people like the programmes you mentioned and the people in Ireland who've given a platform to Dolores Cahill. They are going to make it more difficult for people like us to be heard. And it's not a money thing. It's not about money or support at all. They're just going to put pressure, I think, on the providers not to host us. I mean, we've seen it with David Icke's YouTube channel with nearly 1 million subscribers gone because he dared ask, you know, questions about 5G. We've seen it with others, and it's going to trickle down, Peter. And I don't know what we're going to do about that, to be honest. I really don't.
Well, there are people speaking out, aren't there? I mean, you know, one of the guys that I've got tremendous respect for is Lord Sumption, who's spoken out. You know, you've got Peter Hitchens as well from the Daily Mail. I think he's been doing a fantastic job. But Lord Sumption, former Supreme Court judge, you know, I just wrote a few notes from what he said in one of his interviews the other day. He said that ministers are timid, no real purpose. There's no real purpose in continuing the lockdown other than to spare themselves public criticism. It's a mark of a statesman to stand up for the national interests. He went on to say more than 9/10 of the deaths show that there were multiple causes of death. This is a virus that affects people with serious pre-existing vulnerabilities, and that is consistent with all the statistics, particularly the government's. He advocates that the lockdown should become entirely voluntary, and that it's not for the state to decide what risks we are going to take with our bodies. People who feel vulnerable can self-isolate, and the rest of us can get on with our lives. We have never lived in a risk-free world, and we are never going to live in a risk-free world. For anyone other than someone with serious pre-existing medical conditions, this is a very mild epidemic.
That's right.
In the Cabinet Office papers published with the National Risk Assessments, they have listed all the pandemics since 1918. The mortality of this one is right down the bottom, lower than any of the others. And that's Lord Sumption.
A brilliant voice and a brilliant legal mind, and they have given him a bit of time on Sky. I saw him do an interview with Dermot Murnaghan where he had time, but it's kind of few and far between. It's a lot of the more experienced, you know, again, former barristers, former judges have been saying this, you know, have been saying what an outrage it is that we're in this situation. Look, I think you probably suspect, I wouldn't put words in your mouth, but because of your own journey, from what you've told us, I think you maybe share my suspicion that people like Boris Johnson, his predecessor, of course, Theresa May, and David Cameron before him, Gordon Brown, they don't have much power, Peter, do they? I mean, I see these people as front men and women for another agenda entirely. And when it comes to decision-making...
I think that's absolutely true.
Yeah, that's it, yeah.
I really think that's absolutely true. I mean, you know, for me, I'm not particularly interested in politics. You know, if somebody's from the left or the right or the centre, if they're speaking the truth, that's what interests me. You know, it's the truth. I really do feel, though, that, you know, there are really good people out there. I remember watching an interview with Dr. Bruce Lipton a couple of weeks ago, and he was going on about the coronavirus. But I think the one thing that we can take from somebody with his experience, he said that at any one given time, our minds can only hold either the vibration of love or the vibration of fear. We can decide, we can choose love. Ultimately, everything is volitional. And this is what is being taken away from the pensioners and other people with the constant fear-mongering in the press, in the mainstream media, because maybe these people don't understand that they have a choice. Maybe they don't understand that they can control their own mind and choose love over fear.
We're going to run out of time in 5 minutes, and I'm going to get hammered because we didn't get into the healing too much. So I'm going to ask you to come back again in a few weeks' time, when you have a bit of time, so that we can talk about healing specifically. If you don't mind, you don't have to, but if you do come back, we'd love to have you back.
I'd love to.
It'd be brilliant, Peter, because I am getting a bit of stick now because we didn't get into the healing so much, but I knew we'd talk a lot about the virus. But in the few minutes that we have left, I'm going to indulge myself because I don't get a chance to indulge myself very often. I've got to ask you this. As somebody who loves sport, and I've been to the Crucible, and I've been to the old Wembley Conference Centre to watch the Masters. I've been to Goffs, which is an amazing place, and you had your great moments at Goffs as well, of course. How, when you're 17 frames all, in the World Snooker Championship final, millions and millions of people are watching on television. You're in the Crucible Theatre. There's not many better sporting theatres in terms of the gladiatorial feeling you get there. You're playing against arguably the greatest player to ever pick up a cue, probably shares that with Ronnie, maybe. And I mean, this I've wanted to ask you this for years. How do you hold yourself together in the final frame? How do you stop your hands from shaking, your palms from sweating to the point that you lose the grip of the cue? And how do you even walk to the table? I mean, you were known for incredible, you know, resolve, incredible reserves of mental strength. How do you do that? How does any human being cope with that sort of pressure?
I think it was what I became accustomed to over a long period of time. But, you know, I'd really conditioned myself. The learning that I'd, the processes that I'd gone through. I remember a long, long time ago, a friend of mine gave me a copy of Think and Grow Rich by Napoleon Hill. And then many years later, I was asked for a quote on the back of an updated version of Think and Grow Rich. And I've actually got the book in front of me here. And my quote on the back of Think and Grow Rich was, "It took me 17 years to become world champion, but I always knew deep down that I would win the big one someday. Napoleon Hill's Think and Grow Rich changed my life. It inspired and excited me. And with the belief in myself I received through its pages, I too passed the persistence test." That's one of the chapters in Think and Grow Rich, persistence. "And achieved my lifetime goal. This life-changing book will help you achieve your goals too." So I was always very strong in my mind. I always pushed myself, you know, physically, mentally. And I would like to think that I've taken that focus now and the love and care and compassion that I have as a human being into my healing now. And, you know, it means so much to me to have been, you know, successful in snooker. It's great to have been a world champion, but I really think that I've reached a stage in my life now. It's about what I can give back. And, you know, I really hope that we get the opportunity to speak about healing more in the future. And if I may, in closing, I would like to say that all of us at our core being or soul level are divine love and divine light. We are all individual aspects of the great oneness, and our potential is governed only by the limits we place upon ourselves through both thought and action. Our potential for achievement, creativity, and unconditional love is limitless. We all have the potential to be a force for good and to be kind. We never really know or can fully understand the struggles and hardships that other people are experiencing. Mentally, emotionally, physically, or spiritually. And we can never fully appreciate what an amazing positive impact a kind word or gesture might have on someone or their family. So please be kind.
It's beautiful that, Peter. Somebody once said to me on this program, you can change the world by knocking on somebody's door and asking them how they are. As simple as that. You know, regardless of what you do or what you don't have, you can change the world by just asking after somebody's well-being or doing something kind for somebody. It's a beautiful sentiment, that. Thanks for coming on. And of course, in a few weeks' time, maybe into June, I'd love to have you back on to talk about the healing, because it was really important to me that we did that. But I knew that we'd spend a lot of time talking about the virus and what's been happening as well tonight. So I knew we'd run out of time. But I'd love to spend an hour with you talking about healing and your own journey through that, Peter. I'd be honoured to have you back on the programme. Thanks for speaking.
I'd love to. Thanks, Richie. Thank you.
Not at all. And thanks for speaking up for people, mate, because when you have a voice and you have, you know, celebrity, which is a currency, whether people like it or not, and when people do pay attention to you because of your achievements, it's a marvellous thing to use that to tell the truth and to ask questions. And I'm really glad you're doing that. So thank you very much, Peter.
Thank you.
All the best for now. That was Peter Ebdon, former world snooker champion, live on the Richie Allen radio show Tuesday, the 26th of May. Lovely guy, Peter. A hugely successful sportsman. And he told us this evening about his own journey through the independent media, why he began to take a second look at the press, the print media and the broadcast media in this country, why he did that and how he came to read about alternative researchers. He mentioned some of them, Zig Ziglar, he mentioned earlier on. I know he's read David Icke in the past. I know he's read Zechariah Sitchin and others, and how he's how that's changed him and how that led to him then becoming a qualified healer. Really, really nice guy. Peter was in the press in the last few days because he gave an interview to BBC Radio 5 Live. And in that interview with Mark Chapman, which was a nice interview, he talked a little bit about healing and he talked a little bit about some events in recent history and how he might see those events differently now. And the print media in this country decided, of course, to try and embarrass him and ridicule him. Not that it worked. I think he's above and beyond that now, Peter Ebdon. Thanks to him. And thanks again to Simon Dolan for coming on the programme earlier on. Simon is, of course, taking that legal action against the UK government. He's challenging, through the courts in this country, the legality of the lockdown. And that's going to be, I suppose, coming to a head in the next few weeks, right into June, late June. We'll follow that on the programme. Peter said he would come back on the programme and talk to us about that, so I look forward to that as well. That's it for the show. Going to leave you with this from Bruce Springsteen, and thanks for listening. Great to be back with you. Again, thanks to Simon and to Peter. We'll be back again tomorrow at 5 o'clock UK time with more guests and more chat. It's bye from me. Look after yourselves and one another. Have a great rest of your Tuesday. Bye now.